This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to The Morning Run with Lin-Mark Kusuchuang and Sharitz Abdullah. Now, the government has set up the Debt Management Office effective immediately in order to roll out strategies in efforts to reduce Malaysia's financial burden. Now, this is going to be chaired by the Finance Minister, Lim Guan Eng, and it's going to perform a couple of duties, including scheduling bond issuances and overall borrowings by the government, restructuring any relevant bonds and borrowings, as well as formulating strategies to reduce the government's debt and liabilities burdens.
Yeah, some of the strategies and plans would then be presented to the Fiscal Policy Committee, which is chaired by the Prime Minister. Now, the Finance Minister has said that the DMO was designed to keep government debt and liabilities in check by preventing it from growing out of control, while ensuring that the reckless borrowing made without valid reason would no longer occur.
So some of the luminaries on the committee would include the Chief Secretary, Dato' Sri Dr. Ismail Bakar, the Treasury Sec-Gen, Dato' Ahmad Badri, a couple of private sector individuals, of course, PwC Malaysia Executive Chairman, Dato' Mohamad Faiz, the Economic Advisor to the PM, Dr. Mohamad Abdul Khalid. You've also got the PNB Chairman, Tan Sri Izzetti. You've got the Bank Negara Governor, Datuk Noor Shamsiah. And then you've also got the SE Chairman, Datuk Syed Zain Alba.
Yes, and they're going to be looking at the federal government's overall debt and liabilities, which has previously been stated as being at about 1.1 trillion ringgit, or 74.5% as a percentage of the national GDP as of the 30th of June 2018. Now, the Pakatan Harapan government has done a couple of things since taking office in order to try and sort out this little hole that we're in terms of our debts and finances. I mean, they've set up the Council of Eminent Persons. They've pushed for the resignation of GLC heads. But we've also seen things like Tabung Haji and Felda restructuring. So I guess this new debt management office, the question that it raises for me is, what is it going to add to this very seemingly complicated machinery that the government has in place in order to address this? Is it just adding to the bureaucracy?
It's not entirely clear, but what I guess it does in some ways, reading between the lines, it institutionalizes the financial oversight of the government's debt. It puts and sets a team of people that will diligently, I presume, look at the situation and make sure that the financial plan for the country is as good as it can be. It also puts in place a structure of qualified people that hopefully will last beyond GE14 and into the next administration as well, with whether it's Pakatan or Barisan, so that the government's liabilities and income will be well looked after. And I guess be more interested to find out how frequently the committee meets, what are their powers, what kind of recommendations it would come up with, and how transparent the findings and recommendations will be.
You highlighted, Chuang, some of the luminaries that are on this list of the Debt Management Office, and they are all very busy people, and you wonder how easy is it going to be to get them all in a room to meet, and how often?
Yeah, at the same time, I think it's all about covering as many bases as we can. Previously, we have heard about the new Economic Action Council that was introduced, and that is intended to find opportunities for Malaysia to move forward economically. And looking at the magnitude of debt that we have at the moment, and like it or not, it has to be managed in some ways. And gathering all this head of a very important institution, having them in one table, gives that whole cross sort of sectoral oversight and making sure that everything goes in accordance to plan.
Yeah, accountants like to call all these measures since G14 a kitchen sinking exercise, but the problem with these measures to plug the holes is that it has been expensive and has come at the expense of Malaysia's fiscal reform, and of course that has drawn the ire of foreign ratings agencies. I guess what this also does with these 10 people is that because these 10 people are very, very close to the international money players, the money brokers, and they would because of the closeness to the financial condition of the country, would also be able to talk to the international money brokers and the ratings agencies to placate them about the real direction of the country, which is towards fiscal health.
Now, there are a lot of questions still outstanding, I think, about the Debt Management Office, of course, because it's only just been announced. So this is something that we're going to keep you updated on as the updates come out. Now, the other thing that Malaysia is always perennially concerned about is, of course, jobs. Now, Malaysia is eyeing a deal to send skilled manual labourers to Japan under a new visa program that was launched in April. And Japan, of course, needs more foreign workers due to an ageing population as well as low birth rates. And if the agreement is signed, Malaysia will be the 10th country to provide workers to Japan alongside the Philippines, Cambodia and Myanmar.
Yeah, so foreigners with certain Japanese language and job skills can apply for a resident status for up to a total of 5 years. And we are looking at proficient labourers in construction and shipbuilding, potentially will have the advantage and would be able to extend their stay. So what does the deal entail? We are looking about 50,000 job opportunities that will be potentially be offered, and the sectors that they cover have yet to be agreed upon.
You know how the Japanese are quite finicky about their abilities, right? So what's a Malay word for that? Was it belit or something?
Belit just means weird.
Maybe. they're very picky and they're very detail-oriented. So I guess the Malaysians that we send to Japan will go there already quite well qualified, and they'll come back even better people. I think that's the aspiration, at least.
But there have been some mixed responses to the proposal nonetheless, because there's concern about Japan's treatment of their foreign labourers and fears that it may inadvertently fuel a foreign labour influx. So the minister...
Foreign labour influx to Japan, or to Malaysia?
To Japan. Oh. So there's been also some... I think M. Kulasegaran, the Human Resources Minister, has responded to highlight that it's foolish to think that Malaysians will not seek jobs overseas, even without a formal deal, so it's better to ink an agreement in order to assure they have better protection. So for more insights, we have on the line Dr. Niaz Asadullah. He's a professor of economics at the University of Malaya and Southeast Asia lead of the Global Labour Organization. Thanks so much for coming on the show with us, Dr. Niaz. The HR minister says sending semi-skilled Malaysian labourers abroad to Japan in an exchange will benefit the local economy. How exactly? And do you think this is going to curb or exacerbate our brain drain?
So thank you for having me. I see the reason why the minister is arguing that there is potential for gain from such labor exchange. Perhaps it is because of the fact that Japanese employers highly value labor productivity, talents, technology at workplace, and therefore experience in such a competitive labor market is a valuable and meaningful source for acquiring new skills. But for two reasons, I'm less optimistic. First, we are essentially talking about blue-collar jobs that are repetitive in nature, manual, require manual skills. So I don't quite see how such experience can be a source for acquiring new skills. And we are not talking about jobs where workers would get to work alongside robots and machines. We are really talking about low-value-added jobs at the lower end of the value-added chain. And the second reason why I'm less optimistic has got to do with what economists call the supply side of it. So Malaysia is not a labor surplus country. It doesn't have a large native population either. And it is not known to be a regional supplier of blue-collar workers. And we have our own labor shortage, and there is this constant concern about skills gap in Malaysia. And we rely heavily on both skilled and unskilled foreigners. So I don't see Malaysia competing with populous labor-sending other Asian countries, such as Philippines, to fill the Japanese skills gap in this context.
Dr. Niaz, you make two very good observations there. Your reservations are taken well noted. This is clearly a quid pro quo situation, but if you could second guess the Human Resources Minister, what exactly is in his mind when he inked this agreement?
So, I would emphasize that in theory, this is a good idea. People do talk about the notion of brain gain through brain circulation, or you send your workers overseas, they become better workers, more productive, and you bring them back. So that is the economics behind this. But I think we also have to take into account the timing of this decision. So Malaysia does not have high unemployment rates. If you look at our figures, it's low by international standard, and it is because in the past the economy has been growing, there has been jobs created. But I think there is a change in that context. That there are signs that the economy is slowing down. There are concerns about contraction, partly because of falling external demand. There are signs of deflation. And I think the government inside might be worrying about the future, that there might be difficulties in job creation. And this might be one way to sort of, reduce the pressure. Although, again, we are talking not about millions of jobs. This is a small number. But I think that might be influencing government decisions, the timing of it.
Now, one of the incentives to go abroad one of the incentives to go abroad is as a result of wage disparity. Now, how vast is the disparity between similar jobs in Malaysia if you compare it with Japan or even in Singapore?
You are absolutely right. Globally, high wages drive migration from low-income countries to high-income countries. But we have to keep in mind that Malaysia is not a poor country. It is on course to becoming a high-income nation. Our wages are predicted to rise further. But again, if we make some comparison, there are reasons to believe that wage gap is driving this. So, for instance, think of cleaners or security guards in Singapore. So they would earn in the range of $1,000 to $1,200 per month. In case of Malaysia, in someone holding similar jobs, we are talking about ringgit to 1,500 ringgit per month. So if you do the conversion, currency conversion, surely you would be better off in Singapore. But what we miss is this, that the inflation rate is low in Malaysia. The cost of living is much higher in Singapore. So therefore, when you compare in terms of real wage, it is not a massive wage gap between the two countries. So the question is, why do people still want to migrate? And they want to migrate not just for high real wage. There are other reasons, better public services, access to good quality education for children, better working conditions, and lastly, equal employment opportunity for all. So I think this is a larger context that we should keep in mind when we are talking about the motive for migrating to other labor markets.
Thank you so much for joining us. And that was Dr. Niaz Asadullah at the University of Malaya. And he makes a good point there when he's discussing the reasons that people migrate to other countries. Because we talk a lot about the wage disparity between, for example, Malaysia and Singapore. But there are also other considerations like better working conditions, equal opportunity, access to better public infrastructure. So those are all things that the government may consider looking into if they are looking to curb the brain drain here in Malaysia. So for a bit of background information, data from the International Labour Organization says that there's about 1.4 million Malaysians working abroad. The majority are in Singapore, around 500,000 of them, with smaller numbers in Australia and the US. But according to the Japanese Foreign Ministry website, there are over 18,000 Malaysians living in Japan. Now, Dr. Niaz made a few interesting points in his interview, one of them being that Malaysia is not actually typically considered a labour surplus country. So how are we then going to be competing with other countries like the Philippines and Cambodia and Myanmar, who are also going to be sending workers to Japan when it comes to filling this the gap of labour that Japan is facing?
Yeah, I think the point that the Human Resources Ministry is trying to establish here is not so much about the brain drain or capital. Capturing the brain drain issue is really the issue of labor protection. Because if construction workers go to work in Japan, they don't necessarily get the same kind of like protective measures where health and safety or insurance, etc., concern, housing, food, etc. By formalizing, I guess, this arrangement between ourselves and Japan, this affords our Malaysian workers there a higher modicum of protection.
Yeah, so I think what would be good to see is actually a formal cooperation between Malaysia and Japan to sort of upskill, the workers in Malaysia, find specific areas that we need to develop, especially now that we are in a rush to trying to get to 2030. Having, Tun Mahathir and Japan, the relationship that Malaysia and Japan has now, to be something that is more concrete, more, I think, more targeted as well.
BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.